industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Dr. Jack Jeffrey is a third-year resident in emergency medicine with an interest in toxicology and wilderness medicine.
Today, I will be sharing the story I've entitled One Drop, the Dr. Karen Wetterhahn story. So we're going to just jump right in. Our story begins on a cold winter day, January 20th, 1997. Dr. Karen Wetterhahn was finally convinced to check herself in to Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Her personal friend, Kathy Johnson, a registered nurse, recalled having lunch with her in early January and urging her to see a doctor. Karen had been experiencing vague symptoms for several months, including brief episodes of nausea, diarrhea, abdominal discomfort. She had lost 15 pounds over the last few weeks. But what finally brought her to the hospital was that she was stumbling, falling into walls, unable to speak clearly. Friends remember that she was scared, saying that she finally felt so bad that she could no longer feel safe driving alone. She had her husband pick her up from her lab at Dartmouth College and take her to the hospital. On arrival to the hospital, she was reported to be thin but healthy appearing. She was worried about her neurologic functioning, and her doctors agreed. Her initial examination was notable for upper extremity dysmetria, dystaxic handwriting, a wide base gait, and scanning speech, all signs which pointed to cerebellar dysfunction. Initial CT and MRI imaging did not reveal any acute cause for her symptoms. A lumbar puncture was negative. Initial blood work was within normal limits. However, given that Dr. Wetterhahn was a preeminent researcher in the toxic effects of heavy metals, her doctors pressed her to recall any possible exposures. She reported a spill in August of the past year, many, many months ago, where she was working with dimethyl mercury, stating that 1 to 2 drops fell on her gloved finger and that she immediately cleaned it up, following all proper safety protocols. She stated that she was always wearing the appropriate personal protection equipment, as she always did, and she did not think much of it at the time or afterwards. However, given this new information, urgent testing of her blood and urine for mercury levels was sent off. Her initial blood concentration was 4,000 micrograms per liter, and her urine concentration was 234 micrograms per liter. This was 500 times above the upper limit of normal and more than 50 times the accepted toxic dose. After this new information came out, as Karen continued to deteriorate, she was transferred to the Massachusetts General Hospital for aggressive treatment with chelation and high-dose vitamin E. Karen Wetterhahn, from all accounts from her family, friends, and colleagues, was a remarkable woman. She had studied math and organic chemistry at St. Lawrence University, where she graduated magna cum laude, before earning her doctoral degree from Columbia University, where she studied the carcinogenic effects of heavy metals. She was a fellow at the National Institute of Cancer Research before joining the faculty at Dartmouth College, where she was the first female professor in the Department of Chemistry. At Dartmouth, she was a superstar researcher, mentor, administrator. She was the foremost authority on chromium toxicity, and her research on how hexavalent chromium is taken into cells and reduced to chromium-3 was vitally important to establishing the carcinogenicity of hexavalent chromium. According to her colleague, Kent Sugden, who was a postdoctoral fellow working in her lab, quote, "Karen was the best, if not the best, in metal toxicology. She was the best in chromium." Her work was one of the foundations for Aaron Brockovich's successful lawsuit against Pacific Gas and Electric in Hinckley, California, after the groundwater there had been contaminated with hexavalent chromium from their nearby compressor station. In 1995, she was awarded a $7 million grant from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research and Education Program to study how heavy metal contaminants harm human health. This was at the time the largest grant in Dartmouth College history. It was in the course of her work here that she began research on a project looking at how mercury binds with various proteins involved with DNA repair. Ken Sugden recalled that after a sabbatical where Wetterhahn had been pursuing nuclear magnetic resonance, or NMR spectroscopy, to study the in vitro binding of mercury with various proteins, She returned to Dartmouth to continue the work, and she wanted to do bench work. Her colleagues say that she was excited to be in the lab again, and that as she had been spending less and less time there as her academic and administration duties grew. NMR spectroscopy works by placing sample molecules in strong magnetic fields and measuring the radio frequencies as the different atoms and functional groups absorb the energy. In order to study the effects of mercury on human health, Wedderhorn turned to NMR research. To do this work, however, she needed a reference sample to calibrate the machine. She had initially decided upon mercury chloride salts. The safety and toxicity of inorganic mercury salts was well known. As Sugden put it, quote, "don't eat it." And Wedderhorn felt that it was safe to work with. However, she got results that she was not satisfied with. She did not know if it was the true results or if her choice of mercury chloride as the reference material was skewing the data. At this point, she turned to dimethylmercury. Dimethylmercury is a volatile, colorless, dense liquid at room temperature. It is nonpolar with very low surface tension, which makes pipetting it difficult at times. It is highly lipophilic. While it was known to be toxic, Wedderhorn felt that it was going to be a superior reference standard for the research that she wanted to do. Sugden, who was working on the project with Wedderhorn, recalled bowing out after reading the materials data sheet for dimethylmercury. However, Russell Hughes, another colleague of Wedderhorn's at the time, remembers thinking, quote, "the general consensus seemed to be that the compound required care, but was manageable. Dimethylmercury is a commercial product," he said. Not to be absurd, but nevertheless, not making anyone on her team do work they were uncomfortable with, on August 14th, 1996, Karen was working in the laboratory by herself. We know from her meticulous notebooks and from her careful labeling of samples that Wedderhorn was at the fume hood pipetting dimethylmercury into the tubes required to calibrate the NMR machine when she noted that one to two small drops spilled onto her gloved hand. Wedderhorn was wearing what she thought to be the appropriate PPE at the time, including latex gloves, so she felt that she was safe and did not make any more mention of it in any more of her workbooks, and no colleague at the time remembers her being worried about the exposure. The MDS form, which we see here on the screen, from Alpha Asar, one of only three suppliers of dimethylmercury at the time, noted that rubber gloves, no other specifications, were sufficient for protection and safety. However, as Karen slipped into a coma in the MGH hospital, these safety measures proved to be far too little. After being transferred to MGH, Karen began a more rapid decline. She was started on treatment with oral succimer at doses of 10 milligrams per kilogram every 8 hours, as well as vitamin E being added on in a last-ditch effort as a possible protective antioxidant. The chelation therapy appeared to work, initially at least in the sense of bringing her excretion of mercury in her urine to a much higher 39,800 micrograms per liter. However, her symptoms continued to progress. At MGH, she underwent an exchange transfusion. This reduced the whole blood mercury concentration from 2,230 micrograms per liter before the procedure to 1,630 micrograms 2 hours afterwards, but it shortly returned to a concentration of 2,070 micrograms per liter, reflecting how much of the mercury she was exposed to had already been sequestered outside her blood. Within a week of being at MGH, she began to rapidly lose her vision and hearing. She became increasingly delirious before slipping into a coma from which she never woke up. She was described as being in a persistent vegetative state with spontaneous episodes of agitation and crying. She at times required large doses of Thorazine and Lorazepam to keep her calm. There was never any improvement in her condition after starting treatment. Her team had run out of options, and in following with her previously held wishes, Karen was transferred back to Dartmouth, where she passed away on June 8, 1997, exactly 298 days after her exposure. The medical team was able to learn from this experience, as only two previous cases of dimethylmercury poisonings were recorded in the literature. One was from the 1860s, where two laboratory assistants of Dr. Edward Franklin, the pioneer in organometallic chemistry, also were exposed and showed similar progressive neurologic deterioration. And one from the 1960s, where a German man who worked in a chemical factory producing dimethylmercury, he had been treated with penicillamine chelation therapy without success. From hair strand analysis, they were able to calculate that there's a lag phase after exposure, rapid conversion of dimethylmercury to methylmercury, rapid movement of methylmercury from blood to hair with a half-life of uptake of 5.6 days, and then a first-order decline in the mercury content of hair with a half-life of 75 days that paralleled the decline in blood mercury. They were also able to estimate the total amount of exposure within reasonable assumptions. Based on her initial blood levels of 4,000 micrograms per liter, her total blood amount was estimated at 16.8 milligrams, and her total body mercury was estimated at 336 milligrams, since only 5% of an absorbed dose of dimethylmercury stays in the blood. Given the first blood measurement was 150 days after exposure, and the half-life was 75 days, the total amount she was likely exposed to was 1,344 milligrams. The density of dimethylmercury is 3.2 grams per milliliter, meaning that she only spilled a mere 0.44 milliliters onto her hands, just as she had thought, only 1 to 2 drops. There had been two large outbreaks of organic mercury poisonings in the past involving methylmercury, the first in Minamata, Japan in the 1950s, where the Chiso Corporation was found to be dumping methylmercury into the wastewater from their factory with thousands of recognized cases. Litigation remains ongoing even to this day. The other big outbreak was in Iraq in 1971, where grain, which was not meant for human consumption, but rather to be planted and had been treated with a fungicide containing methylmercury, was imported from Mexico and the United States. Unfortunately, likely due to errors in translation, this grain was consumed by many thousands of people. In this case, the official death toll was 459, but experts believe that this may be an undercount by as many as 10 times. While these historical cases involve exposure through environmental consumption of methylmercury, with likely smaller doses repeated a number of times, the Karen Wetterheim case did show similar progression of the neurologic insults seen in those previous cases. Autopsy was performed with the pictures here of Karen's brain on the left and a healthy, similarly aged woman on the right. The autopsy showed diffuse atrophy of the cerebellum, neuronal loss and gliosis within the primary visual and auditory cortices, more so than the motor and sensory cortices. There was widespread loss of the cerebellar granular cell neurons, Purkinje cells, and basket cell neurons. And an extremely high mercury content was found within the brain of 3.1 micrograms per gram, or 3,100 parts per billion, compared to an average of 2 to 50 parts per billion in unexposed people. The content of mercury in her brain after death was 6 times the concentration in her blood, which shows the high predilection for organic mercury to concentrate in the brain and cause the devastating neurologic injuries that are suffered with those who are poisoned. The Dartmouth community was shocked by Karen's death, particularly those closest to her and working in her laboratory. Not only at the loss of someone in her prime who was seen as an incredible leader, mentor, friend, but also in the way that it had happened. Quote, "Everyone knew dimethylmercury was bad," said Sugden, "but no one knew it was this bad." On a scale of 1 to 10, dimethylmercury was a 15, said chemistry professor Dan Wilcox. "Before Karen's accident, we thought it was a 10. Now we know it's off the scale." Russell Hughes was another colleague shocked by her death. Quote, "I know people who have made bucket loads of this. Frankly, I'm surprised there was not a trail of bodies back through history." Michael Blaney had been hired in 1995 to oversee laboratory safety at Dartmouth. Karen's death was a wake-up call for him. He contacted OSHA to let them know of her death, and an investigation was started. Though Dartmouth ended up being fined $9,000 for inadequate safety protocols overall, the fact remained that Karen had followed all established rules for handling dimethylmercury that were known at the time. This spurred Blaney to do further investigation. In the months following her death, he performed experiments which confirmed that the MDS for dimethylmercury was highly inaccurate. Using the remaining sample from Karen's lab, and with the same gloves from her lab, he showed that dimethylmercury permeates the latex material in under 15 seconds, if not instantaneously. They offered no protection to her, and she was unfortunately likely doomed from the moment the drops hit her gloves. What he did find was that the combination of silver shield gloves underneath a neoprene layer did offer substantial improvement in the permeability. He exhorted OSHA to require the chemical manufacturers test their recommendations for PPE and to work with glove manufacturers to ensure that the safety data was accurate. As he wrote in his study, quote, of the three MSDSs available at the time of Dr. Wetterhahn's diagnosis, one from the manufacturer and two from different suppliers, all had conflicting recommendations on what protective gloves to wear. One MSDS recommended using neoprene, one recommended rubber, and one simply said, quote, wear appropriate chemical-resistant gloves. In March of 1998, OSHA updated their guidelines for working with dimethylmercury and required that manufacturers state that silver shield gloves worn beneath abrasion-resistant materials such as neoprene be the standard. They also exhorted that the use of dimethylmercury be avoided as much as possible. Ironically, the inorganic mercury salts such as mercury chloride that Karen had originally used for calibration have been proven to be just as accurate as dimethylmercury for use in NMR spectroscopy. Dr. Karen Wetterhahn was lost much too soon, but her legacy lives on. She was a pioneering woman in chemistry, and all those who worked with her remember her for not only her pivotal work in the field of heavy metal toxicology, but also how she was an advocate for young scientists, particularly women, in chemistry. Both Dartmouth College and the National Institutes of Health have established awards in her memory for graduate and postgraduate young researchers working in the field of heavy metal toxicology. Laboratory safety measures have changed following her death. Dimethylmercury is no longer commercially available and is no longer used as the standard for calibrating NMR. The irony of an expert in the toxic effects of heavy metals succumbing to severe mercury poisoning was not lost on her colleagues. But as Michael Blaney put it, once in a while, you get to the trembling edge of science and something bad happens. We should remember Karen Wetterhahn for her bravery and her excellence, and use her death as we approach 30 years from the tragic date as a reminder to all of us that our scientists and clinicians must be protected as much as they can, especially in these days as the idea of science itself seems to be falling under further attack. Thank you very much. Here are my references.